Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Common Club of California. We also welcome our internet listeners and radio listeners. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I am the chair of the Psychology Forum. And tonight's presentation by Ms. Chris Stoner is entitled Begin with the End in Mind, the Impact of Trauma on Children's Brains and Bodies. Ms. Chris Stoner has served as the president and CEO of Lincoln since 2006, that's in Oakland, as co-founder of Seneca Center, a nonprofit children's mental health organization. She was instrumental in the design, development, and implementation of innovative services. She also founded InFocus, a consulting company supporting private mental health providers, county departments of mental health, and social services in school districts. She is a licensed clinical social worker, has served on several state and local association boards, and was a recipient of the Exemplar Award from the National Network of Social Work Managers. She currently serves on the board of the National Council of Behavioral Health Organizations and the California Council of Behavioral Healthcare Agency. As a foster parent, she believes that every young person deserves a family, and every parent wants his or her child to succeed. And incidentally, I've passed out question cards. If anybody has any questions, you can write them down, and I'll collect them towards the end of Ms. Stoner's talk, and she will respond to. So please welcome Ms. Chris Stoner.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Good evening, Commonwealth Club. It is so exciting to be here again, and I so appreciate the wealth of knowledge that this institution has brought us over so many years. And I want to especially thank Patrick O'Reilly for putting the Psychology Forum together. I hope that tonight I can provide you all with a few ideas you can take with you, and I hope these ideas lead you to a new understanding of how important early brain development is to each and all of us, and how critical it is to put more resources into our children's earliest moments of life. I'm going to start by asking you a couple of questions. The first, just so I know who I'm talking to and can maybe tailor some of my remarks, how many of you know a lot about brain development and trauma? Come on, a few of you. Okay, great. And what about those of you who know enough to hold a conversation? Okay, good. All right. And what about folks who maybe just came here tonight to learn something about a topic you know nothing about? Excellent. We have a little bit of everything. Well, the fact of the matter is my talk because I wrote it a while ago and I've been practicing it. My brain doesn't switch up very quickly. So my second question, to get you in the mindset of thinking about how brains develop and bringing that home, is I'm wondering if you all have a habit or habits, when you think back to your childhood, that you have developed over the many years that, if you're really honest with yourself, you know come from somewhere you can't really pinpoint. And I'm going to give you a personal example, which now that I have found out there's a podcast of this, I'm sure I'm going to be very sorry. I love the satiny ribbon that covers the edges of certain blankets. I have no idea where this kinesthetic need, compulsion comes from, but I can tell you I find it amazingly soothing and am frankly highly embarrassed when I'm sitting on the couch and I start rubbing the blanket ribbon because it just feels right. So I'm not going to ask all of you to embarrass yourselves this way, but I want you to think about what are those habits or urges or needs that just seem to come out of nowhere that you can't quite identify. Well, that just might have something to do with an early experience in your life. My mom was a seamstress, and she made my baby blankets, and I'm sure that somewhere that compulsion goes back to my earliest kinesthetic experiences. So, You may not fully understand yourself these habits, but you might be compelled to think about it. Now, I want to talk about brain development and how our experiences get embedded into our brains and bodies, and what might happen when a child's experiences include traumatic events. Many of you have heard the diagnosis post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, perhaps. It's most often associated with veterans coming home from war with the remnants and who are having difficulty recovering. Think Tom Cruise in Born of the Fourth of July, or if you watch Grey's Anatomy, Dr. Hunt. Most often this disorder results in flashbacks, emotional outbursts, and in some cases has led veterans to become completely disabled. PTSD in veterans has been deeply researched, but more recently, the same type of disorder is being recognized in children who are exposed to situations like domestic violence, community violence, severe poverty, sexual abuse, mental health issues or substance abuse issues in relatives. Veterans are fully formed adults when they're exposed to war, but infants and young children are a completely different story. To truly understand the potential long-term impact of these early experiences and what we can do to prevent and or reverse it, we have to begin by understanding just how the brain develops. Fun fact, by age 5, the brain has reached 90% of its adult size, while the body is still only 18% of its adult size. Now, thank goodness that doesn't actually happen in terms of physical size, or we'd have a whole lot of bobbleheads walking around when they're young. But we're talking about the formation of the brain, the neural connections, and its capacity. As they shape the developing brain, experiences of early childhood define the adult. Neurodevelopment of the brain has two components: sequential development, or the order in which the brain develops, from brain stem to the cortex, and use-dependent organization. In other words, you use it or you lose it in terms of your neurodevelopment. The mature organization and functional capacities of the brain reflect aspects of the quantity, quality, and pattern of the experiences of the first years of life. During this period, from 0 to 3, more than 1 million neural connections are produced every second. Let me say that again. More than 1 million neural connections are produced every second. You can see here the rapid growth of connections taking place from newborn to 6 months to 12 months of age, and then finally to 2 years of age. It is dramatic growth that doesn't happen anywhere that fast throughout the rest of your lifetime. This growth, of course, eventually slows, and as we become older adults, the brain is in decline, or shrinking, so to speak. That is unless you come to the Commonwealth Club and learn new things. There is a logical sequence to how a typical child's brain develops. Dr. Bruce Perry, a well-known author and trainer who has studied childhood trauma and brain development for decades, describes how a typical child's brain develops and how the brain is altered when young children are exposed to adverse experiences such as abuse, neglect, food insecurity, or community violence. Think of the brain as an upside-down pyramid. At the bottom and developing first is the brain stem, which monitors basic responses such as breathing and heartbeat. The next to develop is the midbrain, which focuses on survival functions such as safety and responses to threats. Farther up this upside-down pyramid is the limbic system, which controls feelings and emotions. And then, of course, the largest and the part of the brain last to develop are the cortical functions, which include our frontal lobes and parts of the brain that control executive functions such as reasoning, planning, anticipating, and predicting. The executive functions develop most rapidly during adolescence and early adulthood. That's why we have adolescents making problematic choices at times. Their brain is not fully developed. But as you can see, that is in fact the largest part of the brain. This is a picture of a healthy developed brain in terms of the proportionality. When a young child is exposed to what we in this field call toxic or repetitive stress, whether within their family or their community, their brain literally develops differently. The area of the brain, the midbrain, that is focused on survival and responses to threats is larger than the limbic system, which helps to control emotions and is equally as large as the cortical area, which controls executive functioning, decision-making, problem-solving. Given this difference in the developing brain, it is no surprise that youngsters exposed to high levels of stress are more likely to have difficulty managing their emotions and behaviors, often resulting in getting kicked out of preschool, if you can believe it, it happens, and set on a path of failure after failure by no fault of their own. They may exhibit hyperactivity, impulsivity, sleep problems, anxiety, and other challenges that make learning and social interaction difficult at best. At Lincoln, we are regularly working with children who have been exposed to such stressors and need a range of interventions to help them manage emotions, play with other children without fighting, complete assignments in school, and we're also working with parents and caregivers to help them more effectively intervene when their child is having a reaction associated to a trauma. Often, many of the children and youth we work with are amazingly smart, socially adept, and capable, but that doesn't mean that they haven't been scarred, and it doesn't and that they don't need support in those moments when a depressive episode hits or a situation triggers a significant stress response. Now we're going to dive a little deeper into emotional development and just how early experiences can alter what is referred to as brain architecture. According to the Harvard Center for the Developing Child, emotional development refers to the ability to identify and understand one's feelings, to accurately read and comprehend emotional states in others, to manage strong emotions and their expression in a constructive manner, to regulate one's behavior, to develop empathy for others, and to establish and sustain relationships. I am not sure I am fully emotionally developed. That is a lot to take on. I would also be remiss if I didn't comment on the fact that this definition likely has a racial bias towards our dominant European American culture. So take that in too. That said, we are going to use it as a marker for understanding the concept of emotional development. According to the center, emotion is a biologically based aspect of human functioning that is wired into multiple regions of the central nervous system. So think about that. Literally wired into your central nervous system. As young children develop, their early experiences literally become embedded in the architecture of their brains. when you think about physical reactions you have as an adult, you feel anger, your face gets red, you have butterflies because you get scared or anxious. These are things that as adults we know how to handle because we have that executive functioning. We can understand why our bodies are reacting the way they are. For a young child, it's so much more difficult. So, and you can see based on this picture, the difference between a child that has had healthy development of the brain versus one that has in some way or another been traumatized or deprived. So how much trauma does a child have to experience and at what intensity in order for the brain's architecture to change? And if it does, can we do anything about it? How permanent is that change? Let's look at the types of stress responses and how they impact the body. In some measure, stress can actually be a good thing. In considering different types of stress responses, Harvard identified three. Positive stress responses, tolerable stress responses, and toxic stress responses. That's hard to say three times. A positive stress response is a normal and essential part of healthy development, characterized by brief increases in heart rate and mild elevations in hormone levels. I am experiencing a positive stress response right now in front of you. A tolerable stress response activates the body's alert systems to a greater degree as a result of more severe, long-lasting difficulties, such as the loss of a loved one, a natural disaster, or a frightening injury. If the activation is time-limited, and I stress this next point, buffered by relationships with adults who help that child adapt, the brain and other organs recover from what might otherwise be damaging effects. Finally, toxic stress responses can occur when a child experiences strong, frequent, and/or prolonged adversity, such as physical or emotional abuse, chronic neglect, caregiver substance abuse or mental health, mental illness, exposure to violence, and/or accumulated burdens of family economic hardship without adequate adult support. This kind of prolonged activation of the stress response systems can disrupt the development of brain architecture and other organ systems and increase the risk of stress-related disease and cognitive impairment well into the adult years. To personalize your understanding of the impact of trauma, let me take you through an experience of mine. How many of you have flown on a plane? Most of you, okay. I was flying to Utah to visit my daughter one weekend, who's at the university there. Short 2-hour flight. I sat next to a woman from New Orleans who was on her way back from California. She was probably in her late 70s. It was her third time flying. And we started up a conversation about any variety of things, mostly New Orleans and how it was doing since Katrina. And as the plane began to level off, we went back to our books. But not long after that, the plane began to rumble. You know what that is, right? Turbulence, they call it. And the attendant asked that everyone stay buckled in. We were experiencing some turbulence. Now, I fly a lot, so turbulence is no big deal to me. But this time, it was different. The plane literally shook for close to a minute, and I could hear bottles rolling under people's seats. And the vibration of the plane and the noise of the engine and the wings were truly jarring. They actually halted the beverage service, which almost never happens, and the pilot came on. You know, when the pilot comes on, then you're in real trouble, to assure us we just needed to get through this patch of bumpy air. The woman next to me clenched her purse, began to cry, was praying under her breath, was clearly terrified. She asked me at one point, is this normal? And I said, well, it was a little worse than I'd seen on other flights, but I was sure the pilot had things under control. And of course, I found myself working to calm my own heart rate and hoping that things would, in fact, get under control. Within what was probably only minutes, but felt like hours, things did calm down. We ultimately landed in Salt Lake, and there we were. Now, at the end of that wonderful weekend, I drove to the airport, as I would normally, through security, onto the gate, lined up in B3360, which is where I always land because I never check in on time, and all was fine until I started down that walkway. I found myself having a physical reaction. My heart rate went up. I was afraid. I kept thinking, where's the best place to find a seat on the plane where I would be okay if something happened? This is something I had not experienced before. But I understood, because of my executive functioning, that this was in reaction to an incident that had happened on my way to Utah. Now, I also could use my executive functioning to think, I've flown a lot, so this reaction that I'm having now is different than that which I had had before. And I've had what I would call, and what we do call, reparative experiences, so that you understand the stress response that you're having is pinpointed to that particular situation. Now, obviously, what I experienced and what my seatmate experienced was certainly not significant compared to the types of stresses that I'm talking about. It was certainly worse for her than it was for me. And at times I've wondered if she's ever flown again. Toxic stress is frequent and generally very high in intensity. To be living daily with unpredictable, ongoing stressful incidents results in stress reactions that become a part of life and literally are built into young children's brains and bodies. This type of stress that, when combined with a developing brain, can be so enmeshed into a child's being that without intervention can sentence them to a life full of setbacks. Think for just a moment about something that makes you nervous. Something you might avoid if you didn't have to do it. Talking in front of a group. Speaking another language. Or even worse, anxiety about your physical safety. And imagine having to face that anxiety every single day and having no control over it. If you're a parent of a teenager, which I have been, you might remember the phone ringing late at night when they haven't come home. What would it be like to face that kind of stress at a moment when you are a child and you have no ability to understand or use your rational mind to combat the emotions that are coming up? Now imagine if you take the impact of significant trauma, such as the unexpectedness of a parent with an untreated mental health issue, or a severe substance abuse issue, or domestic violence, or even living in a community in which lockdowns are a regular part of a school week because of community violence, and couple that with a lack of resources for early intervention and supports. What do you think would be the long-term effect? I'm sure that you want a simple answer, but of course it's complicated. And as I mentioned, the way in which the brain can be altered by trauma is significant. At the same time, there is an important interaction that occurs between the child's developing brain, their own personal genetics, and their environment, including relationships and experiences. Let's consider a few sobering statistics. 80% of inmates in prison today have been exposed to a childhood trauma that has resulted in a mental health disorder. 80%, 8 out of 10. 68% of inmates have not received a high school diploma, likely very much associated with their trauma and upbringing. And depending on what study you read, anywhere between 60 and 90% of youthful offenders, so these are children, adolescents usually, have a diagnosable mental health disorder, as much as 9 out of 10. I don't share these statistics with you to say that these issues are a result, that these issues result in youth ending up in the criminal justice system. But when you think about what might have happened for these inmates, if appropriate supports and interventions were available, how might their lives have been different? It is truly heart-wrenching. Without intervention, childhood trauma becomes part of a child's brain architecture, and their social-emotional capacity can be dramatically altered. It literally impacts how they think, learn, act, and interact with others. To a child who has been exposed to toxic stress, a simple instruction from a teacher can be experienced as a threat. It can result in that child acting out, being kicked out of class, and perhaps even suspended. Repeat this daily, 180 days a year, and eventually you have a child that is not reading at grade level, may end up truant, or worse, involved in the criminal justice system, and certainly likely to drop out of school. And we also can't neglect to pay attention to how race and culture come into play when we're talking about trauma. Because for an African American or Latino child, growing up with the experience of being less than in relationship to Caucasian children, there is the trauma connected to our history of slavery, immigration, and prejudice. The impact of this broader, sometimes more opaque trauma varies widely in terms of its impact and on the larger environment in which they find themselves. Nonetheless, the scars of the messages are there and are carried in the bodies and brains of these children. Associations between positive emotions and the availability of sensitive and responsive caregiving are strengthened during infancy in both behavior and brain architecture. On the flip side, without this critical support, young children exposed to significant trauma can develop serious mental health issues and uneven social-emotional development, which can impact their problem-solving capacity, executive functioning, learning abilities, and difficulty managing emotions. I've got a personal story connected to this idea. My husband and I are were the guardians of a young boy at 7 years old. His mother, Angela, had grown up in foster care, knew my husband and I as staff, and as a very young mother, she was, in fact, a mother of three at 23 years old, she struggled as a single parent and asked for our help. So we co-parented her son. When we had our second birth child and I watched Angela with her, I began to understand how it was that in spite of all of their trials and tribulations, her three children had such capacity for attachment and were able to build lasting relationships and friendships. It was her ability to nurture and care for them as infants, and in spite of her own struggles, to keep them protected.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
That doesn't mean they don't have some scars from their early environments and the community that they were living in, but these had not kept them from being successful in almost every way. The care that Angela provided to her children is considered what we call a protective factor that has been identified as important to healthy brain and emotional development. How do we support and strengthen these protective factors to support brain and social-emotional development? There's really five areas we focus on. The first is parental resilience and really working with families and caregivers, parents and caregivers, whether they're aunts, uncles, grandparents, and making sure they're caring for themselves so that when they're when they need to be there for the child, they are. Improving social connections for families, making sure that families have others to network with, to get support from, to build those family relationships, to get involved in their community. Making sure families, parents, caregivers have knowledge of parenting and child development, provide them with the resources and information that they need so they can understand what's happening for children. And then, of course, making sure that when children are in need, that their families have the capacity to support them. Making sure those skills are there to identify when there's a particular trigger happening for a child, so you can go in and really react to that and provide an intervention. And then finally, ensuring that children have that social emotional competence, supporting caregivers, again, parents and foster parents if the child's in the child welfare system, to understand social and emotional development, to improve both self-esteem and also cultural identity. So now the question before us, what do we do about all of this? Spreading this knowledge is probably the first and most important thing we can do. Dispelling myths that somehow children are born as who they are and what they will be is somehow embedded in their DNA. Or that a child cannot improve their reading if they're behind in first grade because they're just a lost cause. Because the good news is that that science has also helped us to understand that the brain is pliable, has plasticity, as they call it, and it can change and it can adapt. Of course, the earlier a child receives the necessary interventions and those protective factors are in place, the more likely their brain is to create those neural paths and relearn social-emotional behaviors. But the possibility is there. We must think about our social and educational policies and practices and allow this new knowledge to guide us. So a few of the things I'd suggest are universal preschool. If every child had an opportunity to attend preschool, not only would their learning begin with time to ensure readiness for school, it would also allow for the types of social-emotional interventions needed. Early childhood mental health consultation. Embedding therapists and social workers into these programs, as Lincoln has done in its early childhood mental health consultation program, that assists preschool teachers in identifying children who have experienced trauma or are behind in their development so teachers can understand how best to help them. We have to fund best practices in early intervention. Things like nurse-family partnerships, literacy programs, family resources that help families with young children with a range of supports and services, to name just a few. We can pay now or we can pay later. It sounds simple, but often politicians are focused on short-term wins and rarely invested in truly funding these programs at the levels that they're needed. So we continue to spend on the back end, on prisons, much more than we would need to if we brought these services to families early. We have to improve access to services, and particularly substance abuse and mental health services. Everyone needs to have access to these. We have to start treating mental health and substance abuse as though they are just important to us as cancer, heart disease, and all of the other serious medical issues that result in people's lives ending earlier than they should. For those struggling with severe and persistent mental health issues, they typically live as much as 20 years less than the average adult. We have to combat the stigma and blaming associated with these issues and talk about them without fear of judgment. Finally, we have to have racial justice and healing that attends to the larger institutional impacts of racism in our country. 35% of Black children, grades 7 to 12, have been suspended or expelled at some point in their school careers, compared to only 15% of Caucasian children. While making up only 32% of the population, African Americans and Latinos make up 56% of the prison population. And finally, spread the word. There is hope. Science demonstrates that with intervention, and of course the earlier the better, but even intervention for older youth and young adults can alter the impact of trauma. Children can thrive educationally, emotionally, and physically. I thank you all for your interest, attention, and engagement. As you can see, I'm kind of passionate about this subject. And as we continue to learn more about the brain, early development, and the impact of trauma, I hope that you will spread this message loud and clear of hope, so even more people will understand that we are unintentionally doing something to a whole generation of children every time we say no to the types of programs that truly change a child's future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Stoner, we do have a few questions. And the first one is, what about prenatal development and birth trauma?
That is a great question and a whole other talk.
Okay.
The nurse family partnership program I referenced when I was talking about evidence-based practice does focus on prenatal care and engages families that are at risk, women that are at risk, with a nurse who teaches more about prenatally what's going on and how that absolutely trauma, all of these same issues before a child is even born can impact that child's brain.
Okay. And what is the possible impact of the potential educational cutbacks of the current administration?
Dire.
Okay.
We are in a moment in history where we all have to be advocating very hard to ensure that those programs that currently exist don't get cut more, and that we continue to push to make sure these early intervention and prevention services and education programs, early education programs, are supported.
Okay. And one last question. Would you also recommend mandatory kindergarten in addition to preschool?
That is a great question. Yes, I think so. I think I would, on a personal level anyway. And we have some educators in the room. I'd love to hear what they have to say about that. But I do think one of the things that even when parents really want the best education for their children, they don't even know how important kindergarten is. And it is considered optional. So I think probably if we made it mandatory, we'd be in good shape.
Well, a few more questions have trickled in.
I'll do my best.
I appreciate this person because the handwriting is flawless. What about neighborhood revitalization and deconstructing poverty in a way to create more positive environments for children?
Well, I couldn't agree more. One of the things that Lincoln has been doing in the last several years is really working to build family resource centers. We have one in an elementary school, and it really is a support to the whole community. And I think we have to be focused on that larger environment as how we get folks out of poverty.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have two more questions for you. For young people who are older and have been traumatized, how do they learn better behavior? And should an adult caregiver, deal with the acting out? Obviously, this requires a general answer as it is a complex question.
Yes. Certainly, we have worked with kids of all ages at Lincoln and seen older children who have struggled with the impact of trauma. It requires generally more intensive service. We provide, for instance, wraparound services in homes at schools, and it could take longer. Mm-hmm. But that isn't a reason to give up hope. Okay. But it does emphasize how critical it is that we fund those programs that work.
Okay, thank you. And there's one final question, and then we're out of time. Can you give an example of a child story who had help in these areas and state the impact on their development?
I do have a short story about a child that was in one of our summer programs. And interestingly, it is not a traditional mental health program. But she had, a 9-year-old girl had witnessed the murder of a close relative, I think an uncle, and had literally gone mute because of that traumatic event. And her mother brought her to our Freedom Schools program in the summer, which is a reading and cultural enrichment program focused on African-American culture. And she became part of a community that was learning and reading and singing and coming together every day and nurturing those children. And the mother, when she enrolled her, was nervous. She didn't know what was going to happen. Here was this child. She literally had not spoken at school for months. And she became part of this community. And through those nurturing adult relationships and that supportive and protective community, literally within 3 weeks, she was cheering and chanting and singing and reading, and her mother couldn't believe it. But that is just one very small example of a child that has had a horrible traumatic event happen to her, that with those adult supports and that protective environment was able to get through it to the other side.
Okay, well, this concludes this Commonwealth presentation, and please thank you so much, Ms. Stoner, and I believe you're going to be around for a little while if anybody has any additional questions for
you. Absolutely.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.